The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Alan Jones is one of the most respected journalists and news broadcasters in Australia. To find out more about Alan Jones, please visit Alan Jones on Instagram or follow Sky News. Alan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. How are you, brother?
I'm very well. And can I just anticipate something at the outset? Because to all the people who are seeing this, one of the reasons I'm happy to be speaking to Pete is that he has different views. And we're living in a society where there seems to be a growing level of intolerance towards anybody who has a different view, anybody who wants to challenge an existing view. And the manifestation of that is, at the end of the day, your freedoms are taken away from you. And I just think this is a man who actually is not frightened of expressing an independent view, not frightened of disagreeing with people. And I think that attitude towards life and public discourse should be encouraged. So I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you, brother. I can say the same sentiments about you too. I mean, I have been looking forward to this interview for quite some time, and where I would love to start off with is exactly that, is about being able to free think, about having our own opinions, because that's what I believe humanity is about, for us to be able to express ourselves creatively if we're not doing any harm to anybody else. And I feel like in this society where it's becoming more homogenized, more vanilla, more, it's nearly a crime now to be able to speak your opinion. And I know you've been very opinionated in the past, and I think that's a great thing. So tell me about the demise of our free speech that you've witnessed over the last few decades, and is it speeding up?
Well, I think the manifestation of that, Peter, is last night I raised on my television program a real issue, industrial relations issue, whereby a case was taken to the federal court and an employee who was a casual employee believed that that employee was entitled to paid leave. That is the other benefits. Now, a casual employee gets a 25% loading on his hourly rate, and that neutralizes the need to pay all those other benefits. Now, the reason I'm making the point is, I said to Innes Willocks, where are employers in all this? It's going to cost them $40 billion. And he said to me, Alan, they're frightened to speak. And this is where we are today. Everywhere you turn, there will be someone who'll say to you, well, I share your views, but my God, I wouldn't really have the courage to speak, I'll get shut down. It is almost total and complete. Now, at university, the manifestation is, even though a very, very bright student has a particular view about an aspect of politics or the economy, he can't express that view. He wants to pass the exam, and he must subsume to the bloke who's at the front of the lecture theatre who has a totally different view, mostly left, mostly socialist, but the individual is frightened from speaking. So, and at the end of the day, Pete, it's a crisis in leadership. That's the crisis. No one in the public place who's paid by us is prepared to stand up and defend a contrary view. This stuff just goes on.
When did you start voicing your opinion? Was it as a boy? Was it in school? How did you find your voice, and how have you been able to stand in your truth under such criticism over the years? And do you keep getting stronger and more resolute with who you are? Has it toughened you?
Well, I was very lucky, I think, that I had a very intelligent mother, albeit way out in the bush. And she always encouraged you not to be embarrassed or apologetic if you genuinely believe. And I think you made a very good point before. If you're not doing harm to anyone, if you genuinely believe a view, be prepared to stand in the public place, articulate that view, and hope that you'll be able to persuade others to that point of view. Now, people used to laugh at me when I'd go on the ABC's Q&A because they'd have these... And I said, I don't mind. Q&A are biased. Well, of course they're biased. So am I. So is Pete Evans. We're all biased. So your job is to go into these forums and say, well, look, I think I might be able to persuade someone else to my point of view. And there'd be these strips coming across the bottom of the TV screen. I'm hating myself. I'm agreeing with Alan Jones. You know? So, I mean, I was lucky, I suppose, that I was brought up in that environment. And I've never been embarrassed about what I feel or what I believe. And I've always tried to encourage others to have that viewpoint. I mean, for example, Talkback Radio. You can't invite someone, please ring me, 131873, and then when they express a view, go after them. I mean, you've invited them to speak. So it's important to hear what they have to say, and often that will influence what other people might feel. So, I mean, you're doing this all the time. I'm doing it all the time. At the moment, we're fighting a losing battle because out there the general mood is that people are intimidated, embarrassed, and frightened to say what they feel. I think that's what the Trumps did. I spoke very well yesterday, you know, the eldest son and then the girlfriend all made those very valid points that this will be a society where you're happy to celebrate Christmas and you're happy to talk about Easter. But at the moment, you know, we've reached the point where we say happy holidays. We're frightened to say happy Christmas. We've got to fight against that. We've got to push back.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of fear. I mean, I've shared your stories on Sky News recently with the people that follow me on my social media, and it is fascinating. How I usually start it off is, don't worry about who is saying the message, listen to the message. And I did that today. I shared something from Tucker Carlson, I've shared Andrew Bolt, and as I said, I've shared yours before. A lot of people can't get through who's saying it to hear the message.
Separate the person from the message. I understand that. I mean, we've got this at the moment. I think actually, Peter, there's going to be a reckoning here over this coronavirus. I know you've had a lot to say about it. I'm not concerned about the coronavirus. I'm concerned about the response, where you actually take all sorts of liberties and freedoms away from people. And you've got people in Melbourne living like battery hens. And there are epidemiologists all over the world. And I've cited stacks of them. And I'll be citing two more new ones tonight who just say this is wrong. Lockdowns don't achieve anything. But here you've got governments with all this power and seeking to accumulate more power. And what are we? We're such a peace-loving, pliant mob. We just surrender and cop it. Well, I think the day is coming when we're not going to cop it. And as I keep saying to Morrison, the quiet Australians are going to become very noisy and angry Australians.
Yeah, so I'm not savvy about politics. And maybe there's a lot of people in Australia that are like me, that they don't understand how it works. And that's something that I wanted to ask you about today. Is how does it work? And from my understanding, what they're doing is perhaps unconstitutional, say in Victoria, maybe I'm wrong. And what are the solutions for this? There has to be a solution for this.
Well, I suppose Churchill got it right when he said, democracy is not much of an idea, but it's a lot better than the alternative. The real problem here, I think, is that the caliber of politicians. That's the first thing. I mean, many of these people, you'd give them a job, I suppose, as deputy principal of a primary school, or you'd be happy to have them as the mayor of the Hurstville Council, but not of running Australia. I doubt many of these people have read books. I doubt many of them could spell epidemiological. And so do they know what that is? So we haven't had any leadership in this coronavirus crisis. We've just had followers. So one or two health people say, well, this is what should happen. And they say, all right, that will happen. Now, you take the classic example. I'm not getting personal here. I'm just talking reality. The woman who's the health officer in Queensland, the chief medical officer, she did a bit of a gig at the emergency wards here at Westmead Hospital in Sydney. She then got a job as an administrator at Rockhampton Hospital. She shifted from being an administrator there to Princess Alexandra Hospital, and now she's the chief medical officer, barking instructions at business as to what they should do, closing down borders. You're right, Pete, it is unconstitutional, Section 92. But who is defending the Constitution? Only Clive Palmer. Only Clive Palmer is prepared to go into court and challenge the constitutionality of what they're doing. Now, I'm simply saying if a Liberal Prime Minister isn't prepared to defend and fight for the Constitution, what is he prepared to fight for? And they're all silent on all of this. And so the lockdowns, I mean, I've cited Nobel science physicists who've said lockdowns don't work. But here is this Daniel Andrews seeking more and more power. And people living like battery hens in Melbourne. And 5 million Melburnians have lost everything. The mental, social, psychological, emotional, let alone economic damage is incalculable.
I have a friend who's a police officer, and he said that the amount of suicides that he has been reported and he's had to attend to, and he said the media won't report on them because unless they're a murder suicide, however that works. And I'm just, people keep talking about these people that are dying from this virus, and it is sad, whatever is the outcome of that. But at the same time, where is the balance? Where is the long-term effects of what is happening now in Victoria and potentially that's going to roll out through our other states in this country, and New Zealand I see as another huge disaster zone waiting to happen in the coming months. How do we reconcile this?
You can't. You see, I've been quoting a table issued by the World Health Organization in October last year. And it's a very simple table. And it has in a left-hand side, I put this on TV, and I'm reading the words here now, not recommended in any circumstances. This is to address pandemics and epidemics. So there are three columns on the table issued by the World Health Organization in October 2019, not recommended in any circumstances. And amongst the things not recommended for a pandemic, and you've got to say this slowly, in any circumstances, I quote the exact words, contact tracing, quarantine of exposed individuals, entry and exit screening, border closures. That's the World Health Organization. I mean, who do they take no notice of this? The Lancet Medical Journal said it's the most reputable medical journal in history. It's been functional and recognized for over 200 years, said this year, in our analysis, full lockdowns and COVID-19 testing are not associated with reductions in the number of critical cases or overall mortality. These people are telling us untruths, Peter. That's my concern. Morrison made the statement himself on March 15, it was, this year, when he said for 80%, 8 out of 10, it'll be nothing more than a flu. Now, he was wrong there, but understandably wrong, because now the World Health Organization says it's 9 out of 10. And then he said, and I've got his exact words here somewhere. He said, we then must, here we are. I said last week, for the majority, around 8 in 10, this is the 15th of March, it will be a mild illness and it will pass. However, for older Australians and those that are more vulnerable, particularly those in remote communities and those with pre-existing health conditions, it is a far more serious virus. And that is our concern. Our aim in all of this is to protect the most vulnerable. What have we done? We've smashed the economy. It's cost $400 and something billion. And we've now got a Royal Commission into aged care to indicate that those people who were most vulnerable haven't been looked after. And they are the bulk of the deaths.
So moving forward, I want to know, you're an influential person. There are many people in business that are influential, that have power. How do we find a solution? I mean, if you had a crystal ball or the genie's lamp and you could make three wishes at the moment, what would it be? How do we get out of this mess in a logical, lawful, if that is appropriate, manner?
Do you mean the health mess or the economic mess?
Everything. Just how do we move forward?
Just on the health mess, again, there is a leading academic from Oxford University, a lady, Professor Gupta, who has said what I said at the beginning and indeed what Boris Johnson said at the beginning, but then he was dissuaded from that. And she just said, the best way out of all of this is to allow everybody who's not at risk, and these are the people that aren't under 70 that aren't elderly, that don't have comorbidities. I mean, I'm one of these people. I've had cancer and God knows what, so I'm at risk. But the people who aren't at risk, let me on with their lives, let this herd immunity occur, and eventually the nation will be immune and we'll get on with it. Now, no one wants to know about, they've crushed everybody. I think the answer to the health issue is to now confront the public with the reality. There are any number of epidemiological experts around the world, from Stanford University, Oxford University, who will tell you we have completely over-egged the pudding here. So the way out of the health thing is to stop scaring people. The World Health Organization put a document out every day, and there it is there. I've got it from here today, Wednesday, and it says on the front of it, I don't know whether the camera gets hold of any of that, but right on the front it'll tell you how many, what percent, critical or serious, 1%. And in the world currently, there are 61,000 people in a world of 7.7 billion, 61,000 people critical. But if you turn over the page from the World Health Organization, it'll then tell you as at today, as at this very same date, we've had 822,000 deaths from coronavirus. As at the same date, 8.4 million deaths from communicable disease, 5.3 million from cancer, 3.2 million from smoking. So the answer to the health issue is to tell the people the truth. Now, the economic, and that is to say, you are not at risk. Peter Dutton had this. He got back on with his, Richard Wilkins had it. Get back on your horse and you'll be okay. Young person working for me here has had it. He's 20 years of age. He had it. He went into quarantine. Mother locked him up in his bedroom, pushed sandwiches under the door, and he survived. But the economic front worries me, Pete, because there are businesses here that will never come back into business because of the response that's been taken to this based on what I call complete untruths. And the only way you can do that, you can't tax your way to wealth. So we now got to try and grow the cake. And how do you grow the cake? Well, we've got to create an environment in which people are going to exercise their entrepreneurial skills, where people are going to feel free to employ people, where people are going to reduce the taxes, let people keep more of what they earn. But I'm not too sure we've got the intellectual clout in Canberra to be able to marshal those arguments, let alone persuade the electorate, because they're not going to trust them. They've got this wrong. Why would you allow the people who got us into the mess to be given the responsibility to get us out of the mess? And the classic case of that is in Britain in the war. Now, Churchill was brought in after Chamberlain in 1940 to lead the world, really, and Britain in the war. And, of course, in 1945, there was much celebration. War was over, and they had marching in the streets and flags and all the rest of it. And so all the advisors of Churchill said, we'll call an election. So Churchill called an election 45 days after the declaration of peace, and it was going to be a walkover for the Conservative Party. But the fact is, the people of Britain didn't believe that the bloke who'd prosecuted the war could actually prosecute the peace, and it was the biggest swing in British political history. 10.4% of the Labour Party, and indeed Clement Attlee, the Labour leader, won 189 seats from the Conservative Party. And I sense here there will be very, very significant political retribution towards those political leaders who've taken young people, you talked about suicide, young people into levels of suicide and trauma and distress that they've never known before, families who now no longer have a business and no longer have a job. When all of this manifests itself, at the end of the day, someone is going to have to be accountable. And those accountable are the political leaders who responded to this in the wrong way.
I've heard people talking about that we can't sue the government, we can't attack them, but we can potentially sue the individuals, I think, as you were alluding to then. True or false? Do you know, understand what the potential of that is?
Well, the difficulty, yes, it has its potential. But see, Pete, you know yourself, if today you decided you wanted to take action against me because I owe you $10,000 and you're desperate and you need the $10,000, you reckon you lent it to me and I didn't pay you back. Well, first you go to a lawyer and you got the clock ticking. The only reason you're after the money is you need it. It's going to cost you a fortune to take me on. And many people then back off and say, well, I can't afford it. It's not worth it. And this is the system of justice. In this, only the rich can afford justice. I mean, the poor bloke's been trampled and downtrodden. The person that's lost his business. The person that's lost his job. The person that's lost a mother who should never have died because Morrison promised to look after the vulnerable. and hasn't. Those people have no redress. They say, oh, the courts are there. Well, hang on, Daniel Andrews wants to increase the level of emergency in Victoria so the chief health officer can give the police the power to suspend legislation. Now, have you heard? I mean, you're an alert person. You know what's going on in the world. Have you heard a prime minister or a leader of the opposition proclaiming to the world, get me on TV, I've got to tell them this is what Daniel Andrews is about and it will not happen in a country I lead? No. No more than they'll defend the Constitution. We have a crisis in Western political leadership and the things we're facing today are a consequence of that.
I hear there's a class action lawsuit that is underway through a very determined and passionate lawyer in Victoria called Serene. So what are the thoughts about that? Because you said the economic hardship...
Well, basically, the Victorian case, which I think is likely to be successful, derives from changes that Andrews made to BRAC's industrial relations legislation of 2004. And last year, Andrews adjusted that legislation, amended it, to incorporate provisions of what he called industrial manslaughter. Now, the industrial manslaughter provisions were designed to trap the quote-unquote tall poppies, the big employer who, through brutal or ruthless or manipulative behaviour, led to the death of somebody, either in the workplace or as a consequence of the workplace, and therefore you could file against the employer for industrial manslaughter. It's very draconian legislation. Now, what has happened is that Andrews has implemented these draconian measures without giving him statutory power, because in that legislation, ministers and the government are not exempt. So what is now being argued by that lawyer in question, and there's very significant support for it, is that as a result of things that Andrews did or did not do, then people have died, people have lost money, people have lost businesses, and this will apply to the aged care providers as well, that as a result of the failure to properly protect these people from a virus, which everybody knew about following Newmarch House in New South Wales, these people have died and they come within the provisions of the industrial manslaughter legislation. So what has to happen then is someone makes application, which these lawyers are doing, and that has to go to a particular tribunal. If the tribunal rejects the application, it must give written reasons. If then you don't accept the rejection, you can go to the DPP, the Director of Public Prosecution. If he won't accept the validity of your case, he must give written reasons as well. So my conclusion from all of this is I think Andrews is in very significant trouble. But again, where is Morrison? Where are people talking about this? Where are people alerting the public that there is some hope that people who have imposed these punitive regimes on innocent, ordinary and trusting Australians, that they're going to get their chance in court? I mean, this is the crisis in leadership we face.
I mean, the most basic question I have to ask you is, surely these politicians know that there's blood on their hands, or are they oblivious to it or ignorant to it?
Well, I hope they'll bluff us out of it. You see, Morrison's now saying, oh, I'm terribly sorry about aged care. I'm terribly sorry these people have lost their lives. And I've said, listen, sorry, none of this rhetoric will wash. You gave a commitment on the 15th of March that you'd protect and look after these people. It's easy to know how to do it. All you had to do is to take all people who are vulnerable. All the hotels are empty in Australia because we've stopped tourism. That's another story. We've stopped tourism. We could hire the hotels, rent the hotels, put every elderly person at risk in there, and you lock them up, give them a dignified existence in the hotel, provide all the medical care that they need. But Andrews in Victoria wouldn't allow sick people in aged homes to go into hospitals because they might wander in the hospital and the other people will contract the virus. So what do? They drug them in the aged people's home so that they weren't able to be of any danger to anyone. I mean, we need national leadership that will hold these people to account.
My family and I have been using beautiful, high-quality essential oils for the last 20 years to live healthily every single day. Now, if you're passionate about health and are ready to step into leadership, I want to invite you to partner with my team and I to build a beautifully successful doTERRA business. Register at petehlc.com/pete. That's Pete, HLC, which stands for the Healthy Living Collective, .com/Pete.
I read recently that the deal that Scott Morrison has done, or the government has done, with this so-called vaccine manufacturer, that vaccine manufacturer has paid out over $1 billion in fines and questionable things. Now, my question would be, why would an Australian politician that's searching for a vaccine for this virus form a partnership or a relationship with a pharmaceutical company that's paid out already $1 billion in fines for, I'll let you do the investigation, but let's just say that it is highly questionable. $1 billion. We're not talking $1 million, $1 billion.
Well, you asked before about how government operates, and unfortunately, a government responds to very powerful lobbying interests. And the big drug companies have enormous influence. And as a result of that influence, there are, and I've interviewed people on my program about this, there are existing drugs in the market, which no one is saying are likely to eliminate this particular flu, and it's just a serious flu. And no one's, there are drugs in the market, but they won't acknowledge them, they won't approve them. The Therapeutic Goods Administration won't approve them. And you can only come to the conclusion that there are big drug companies out there waiting for a vaccine to come onto the market where they'll make a big quid, and somewhere along the line there'll be a few other people with brown bags. Now, the vaccine you're talking about, I noticed that the churches have a bit of a problem with it because it uses cells from an aborted human fetus. And that's the one that they're talking about here. And I noticed that the Catholic Archbishop and the Anglican Archbishop have said, look, we know life is important, and that's why we're actually talking about pioneering vaccines. Life's important, but hang on. You can't say on the one hand life's important, therefore we must have this vaccine, and on the other hand the vaccine derives from a cell from an aborted fetus. So there are many ethical questions about all of this, Pete, and your point about sponsoring and encouraging companies who have already offended in the public place doesn't pass muster. But who is promoting this? Who's arguing this? Who prosecutes this in the parliament? It doesn't happen. We don't have government of the people, by the people, for the people. We don't have it. That's a myth.
Will we have it?
We should have it, but I suppose we're to blame. You and I are to blame, and everyone else is to blame. We allow them to get away with this. I mean, for example, you're not standing, I'm not standing, other people are not standing, so we can't really complain about the calibre of these people. But at the end of the day, it's disappointing that we do trust the democratic process, and I think in this, it's willfully let us down.
Sorry, my dog is barking there. I've got a question for you that I'm challenged by, she's challenged by it too. Good girl. The deals that have been done by Daniel Andrews and I think Jacinda Ardern over in New Zealand with China, the Belt Road Project, what influence does that have on what's happening at the moment? Is it just coincidental that there seems to be potentially some sort of synergy with what's going on in the world, or is that not coincidental at all?
Well, you see, this is where you get into trouble, and yet where you are right. See, by asking those sorts of questions and for having, that's not a cynical question. It's a very legitimate question. I'm looking at this tonight. I mean, the Belt and Road Initiative. What is the Belt and Road Initiative? The Belt and Road Initiative says to all these little satellites in the Pacific, New Zealand, everywhere. Now, look, I know you've got problems with infrastructure. You need airports, you need railroads, you need whatever. Look, we'll lend you the money for all of that, and so that you'll be strong in the Pacific. Well, of course, at the end of the day, they can't pay, and all of these little outfits become indebted to China. And it's what they call the soft approach towards China taking charge in the region. Now, only this week, we've had the argument that academically, China has entered the fray in universities in Australia, whereby they appoint people to this, what they call a talent program, and they pool the research in relation to innovation, in relation to technology, in relation to, you know, military equipment. But that's all got a patent, has got to be registered in China. And if you actually be part of it, you're an academic person who's part of it, we'll not only give you the university salary, but a Chinese university will pay you a bit of a bonus on top of all of that. Now, here is China moving in to virtually pirate our scholarship to improve their military strength and their missile capability, and we're asleep at the wheel. Look, this is analogous to the 1930s, and you might remember that Chamberlain went and signed the Munich Agreement with Hitler, arguing that, look, it's all right, I've sold it, and it came out waving the piece of paper and was appeasing with China, and then next day they invaded Poland and we're all at war. So we're asleep at the wheel here. So again, your concern, you're saying, oh, well, I'm not too sure. You're on the right tram, my friend. These people, this is soft diplomacy and they're moving in everywhere. Now, however, what's happened? Well, we've sold our best beef farms. We've sold all the dairy farms in Tasmania. We've sold our cherry farms. We've sold our avocado farms. We've sold our water. We've sold our minerals all to China. What do we get from it? Nothing. We've given the Port of Darwin, a 99-year lease to the Port of Darwin. And these are Australian politicians who were swallowed all of this and China are laughing at us. So the pushback now is going to be very difficult. But yes, China in the South China Seas, they're now building little satellites in the South China Seas. And eventually what's going to happen? Are they going to block the South China Seas to us where we get all our imported oil that comes from Middle East via the South China Seas? So all of these things, we should have politicians who are alert and at the wheel and aware, but I don't think the scholarship exists for them to actually embrace these particular issues, and they are of real concern. Yes, the China involvement in this region is very, very significant.
How are you allowed to say what you say on a mainstream news channel? I mean, do you personally, it's just a question I have for you, your freedom to speak your mind about all of this is, I applaud you and I congratulate you and I'm so grateful that there's somebody out there with a voice that's articulate and intelligent and has been around the block, so to speak, quite a few times, that can deliver a message that penetrates people. How, I mean, my perception of media is it's very controlled.
About it is today. It is today.
So how do you have the freedom to do what you do?
Well, I suppose many people say I don't, but there are people who try to shut you up. But look, I don't know. You've just got to stay there, Pete. You've just got to stay on the front foot. I'm sure there are many people who are comfortable about that, because I think on the China issue, you tell me any place in Australia that isn't dependent on China. I mean, here we are in all this debt. I suppose they think that China will help us get out of the debt. Well, I'm simply saying you pay a price for all of that. Look, you can't balk, you can't back off, you can't be intimidated by, there's too much at stake. I mean, I think of the, you know, the little kids that haven't been born today who'll be paying off this debt that we've run up. You know, if you think of what happened when Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd went into all that, you know, pink bats and building the education revolution and cash for clunkers and so on, and they were politically buried. And very intelligent Tony Abbott said to me the other day, you know, he said, it's funny, isn't it? Labor would never have spent this money. Labor would never run us up this debt, because they would have been so terrified, they would have been belted up like they were last time. But here we are now with Morrison, who's just gone out, it's money every day, it's now up to $400 billion. The debt's coming to $1 trillion. It's just unbelievable. I remember when they laughed at Kevin Rudd. Well, didn't laugh, they went after him. When Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister, he wanted to raise the debt ceiling to $75 billion. And that was the point. You couldn't go beyond that without parliamentary authority. You couldn't run the national debt up beyond $75 billion. And they said, oh, typical socialist Labor Party, aren't they hopeless, irresponsible? We're the economic managers. The debt ceiling, hello, it's heading towards $1 trillion. $1 trillion. Kevin Rudd wasn't that long ago. $75 billion is a big difference. So you've got to keep saying it, Pete. That's the answer. And there's a golden rule in politics. When you're sick of saying it, they're only starting to hear it. And I think slowly the Australian electorate are starting to wake up, and that's why people like you and I and others have got a responsibility to keep saying it.
What's your intention when you get out there on your news program in front of that camera? What's your intention? Because obviously you and your producers write your editorial and what you're about to say.
Now, I write everything.
You write it yourself?
I write everything.
Apologies.
Look, but when I get out there, I'm just Alan Jones. I take a subject and I say, this is what I think. This is not what someone else thinks. This is what I think. And I think that's why, if I might say modestly, I mean, I won radio ratings for 35 years because I think people appreciated that I wasn't mouthing someone what someone else had said. This was me. If you don't like me, as my old man said, well, the bloke who invented the wireless was smart, but the bloke who invented the knob was even smarter. So I don't like it at all. turn it off, you see. But they don't seem to turn it off. And, you know, since we started here, the editorial comment, I've only been going about 6 weeks, the editorial comment has been seen by almost 14 million viewers. That's a lot of people. So people are hungry out there, thirsty for what you're on about, a different view. The reason you've got a following is you don't fall into line with everybody. Well, our leaders are not leaders, they're followers. The medical people say, oh, this is it. All right, that's it. Close the border. I'll close the border. No. And I mean, your whole appeal is the fact that you have a viewpoint and you don't apologize for the viewpoint and you articulate the viewpoint. And out there, they're hungry for it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be listening to you or me. So that's the encouraging thing. Now, how do we mobilize that to secure the change we need? Well, that's the next question, isn't it?
Yeah. Can you answer it?
Yes, I think I can. I think I can. Look, I can answer that because I suppose I'm a super optimist. The only thing is, as you know, I mean, the history of the world demonstrates that change comes, the kind of change we seek, comes very imperceptibly. It's very slow. And therefore, eventually, you've got to, and that's what's happening right now. Like, this thing's been going on, coronavirus, for 8 months, but now they're starting, as public are starting to say, I think we've been deceived and I need to know more. And once that happens, there will be, for example, there's been a significant reticence now about locking down. Now, I'm not taking any credit for that, but I think I started the argument that this lockdown has no epidemiological validity, none. Well, now, apart from Andrews, who got into it, but now there are various premiers shirking, frightening, stepping back from the lockdown. So we'll eventually win this. My only concern is the legacy of this mob of left is like nothing we've inherited, 400 and something billion dollars from this, debt going to $1 trillion. That bothers me. And so the only way you can pay for that somehow, Pete, is to grow the cake, grow the economic cake, and that will require very significant economic and industrial reform. So the challenge is, I resent the fact that we're being asked to turn this around because it should have never occurred in the right place. And that's why, first place, and that's why I keep saying the issue, and you've said this, the issue is not the virus. The issue is the response. And the response, in my opinion, has been completely wrong. And I said that from day one.
I've got a couple of other questions because I know we're short on time. The first one is, what's happening in America with Donald Trump at the moment? And my personal perception, and this is just me, is that if he loses, then the ripple effect of that situation will be felt around the world. I respect the man, and I have a fear. I watch his press conferences every day, and he seems to be very articulate as far as anybody can be in speaking each and every day. And maybe articulate isn't the right word, but he's definitely passionate and intelligent, highly intelligent. That's my perception anyway. So what happens, because you must have studied this, what happens if he does stay in power and what happens if he doesn't stay in power? What are the ramifications?
The last bit first. Firstly, I agree with the sentiments entirely. Trump really is the hope of the side. And he talked about draining the swamp. My God, how deep is our swamp here that needs desperate draining? So, and he's been challenged. The reason he's been challenged for 4 years and trying to argue the illegitimacy of his office is because he has threatened all those people who've been the beneficiaries of the mess of the past. And he stood up to the enemies. He's defended certain freedoms. He says, under Donald Trump, you'll be able to have Christmas again. We won't be saying happy holidays. You'll be able to have all of those things resonate with people. And I don't, as where I'm standing here today, what is the day today? The 26th or something of August. We're a long way away. I don't think there's a hope in hell of beating Trump, because there are silent people, silent majority, and they know that pre-coronavirus, his record was second to none. He's been a businessman. He knows how to do all of this. You're quite right. He's highly intelligent. He's different too. He exaggerates a bit here. And he's a playboy. He's a theatre man, but politics is theatre. But, I mean, the other man, apart from reading an auto cue, it's very sad that someone's been in the parliament for 47 years and has got nothing to show for being there for 47 years other than longevity. Now, to take the other side of it, which I'm a super optimist, so I don't even contemplate that, but were Trump to be beaten, then I can't see anyone at all really capable of asserting a return to the freedoms and the values that we have lost in so many other administrations around the world. I must say that Macron in France has changed direction recently, which encouraged me about the militant behaviour of certain minorities. So, and Macron is very bright, but I don't know whether he's a chance. Merkel is going to go. Boris is all over the place on so many ways, very bright. Trump is the bloke who just stands his ground. And I think the Nikki Haley said that yesterday. And, you know, I think that at the end of the day, we are insignificant, and this will get us both into trouble. But I don't care. I mean, if Trump were to lose, then the forces for massive change, you know, in the way we educate our kids, the things that are taught in the classroom, the way we manage the economy, in the difference between debt and capital, these things are all going to go out the door. And the whole world will, you know, the climate change thing is classic. I mean, it's only 8 years ago that one of the delegates to the International Conference in Cancun, the climate change conference, said, don't start imagining this is an environmental movement. This has nothing to do with the environment. This is about a wealth transfer. This is what the intention is. And we've been suckered in by all this. Well, old Donald wasn't. He said, no, I'm not signing up to Paris. I'm not signing up to Paris. Then you've got Schellenberger, who was one of the leading environmentalists in the world over 20 years, unapologetic environments. In July last month, he wrote a long treatise via a book which said, I just apologise for being part of a campaign which has duped the people. Climate change does occur, but it's nowhere near the most important environmental issue. And he said all many of these things that have been said in the name of climate change have no validity. So, you know, Trump has been in the vanguard of all of this. To think that he may be done over, and I think what was good about the Republican convention, I have to say to you, Pete, is that suddenly we saw a couple of people there, I think, who are legitimate successors. In other words, it's not just a matter of the name. I mean, the son, Jared Trump, was outstanding. And then that Nikki Haley, if you're talking about a female American president, Nikki Haley was just, and they were all her. So there are people out there that are prepared to fight against these forces of negativism that exist, that tell us we're racist and tell us that we've got a terrible history and we must knock down monuments and so on. Well, someone's got to stand up against that, and Trump is the hope of the side.
Who have we got here in Australia that is the equivalent of that?
No one. No one in office. A good number of people. I mean, I thought Abbott was outstanding because he's a man of independent ideas. Abbott writes his own speeches. Abbott speaks his mind. But he was white-handed by Turnbull from the moment he got in there. We've got very good people in the parliament, but they're not in the front bench because Morrison doesn't like long shadows. So how could you explain Matt Canavan is not in the ministry? Andrew Hastie, Amanda Stoker, James Patterson. There's a stack of good people out there, and they're people with ideas. They're people who've read books. They're people who learn, who understand the political process. Them getting to the top of the tree is difficult. But again, Pete, I'm the optimist. That'll all change. It'll have to change, or some of these political parties can't survive. And hence we're seeing now the challenge to the leadership of the National Party. This fellow McCormick, he's hopeless. He couldn't lead a horse to water. And it's taken them 2 years to wake up. But when they suddenly see that the electorate is going to reject us unless we make change, then that change is forthcoming. So I'm an optimist, but my God, there's some hard work to be done.
And lastly, last week, Scott Morrison said when the vaccine does come through, it'll be mandatory. And then 6 or 7 hours later, he retracted that and said it will be encouraged. Now, there's a lot of people that are on my social media pages that would say the encouragement will be in the shape of you can't travel, you may not be able to go to work, your kids may not be able to go to school unless they have the vaccine. Where do you see this going over the next 6 to 12 months if and when a vaccine does come?
Right. Well, I mean, it is central, you see, Pete, it's central to everything we've been saying for the last hour. I don't understand how a Liberal government, which has historically been born out of, when Menzies said, the defence of freedoms, and that's why we went to war, that's why people gave their lives in defence of freedom and a range of freedoms, personal freedom significant, national freedom, religious freedom, and so on, how then they can say something has to be compulsory. For example, I'm opposed to compulsory voting. Why should voting be compulsory in an allegedly free society? You ought to choose not to vote. Choose not to vote. That's your business. Why then should anything be compulsory? We can't be running around saying, oh, well, you will be vaccinated. If you're not, you won't get this benefit or that benefit or the other benefit. I would rather say, well, people are intelligent people. I'm relying on them to make up their own mind as to how they want to best protect themselves down the track. And that's how we should have been responding to this flu virus. They call it virus, the flu. We should have been saying, well, listen, aren't you smart enough to safeguard your own health? We'll give you the parameters. I'll give you the parameters. And he gave us the parameters when he said, for 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10, it'll be nothing more than a mild flu. And then there's vulnerable people that look after. So away you go. And that's what they said in Sweden. Organise yourself. So the businesses weren't closed down. People weren't put out of work. The vulnerable, the elderly, the people who'd had preconditions, comorbidities and whatever, took the appropriate care. They isolated, they went away, they locked themselves up and so on. So that's the way in which we should exercise the control of our own destiny. That's your responsibility, my responsibility. We don't need Big Brother up there invested with phenomenal power telling us what exactly we can and cannot do. Okay, we do have to pay tax because we must do. But even then there's a limit. We draw the line. We do say you've got to drive down the left-hand side of the road because if we pleased ourselves, I suppose we'd be killing people. But in general terms, a Liberal government, which bases its whole political philosophy on the pursuit and embodiment of freedom, is then about, right now as I speak and in relation to vaccines, denying freedom to people who want to make a choice for themselves. Someone's got to point out the paradox and contradiction of all of that. It doesn't hold up.
Brother, that was amazing. I've said it from pretty much the last few months that I think this is all a scam. And what I mean is perhaps the virus exists and does, but something just seems fishy. And it feels like our politicians may be in a position where they don't really know which way to go. And maybe they're stuck. And a scam, I think by definition, is to do with business and to swindle people out of money. So,
well, at the moment, of course, it's being used. I think they think it's being used to cement political power. They somehow think they'll be able to say to people, see, you're alive today. Do you know why you're alive? Because I took all these draconian measures to keep you alive. Therefore, please vote for me. Well, by the time that question is asked, they'll say, hang on, you had nothing to do with keeping me alive. This was a virus that wasn't going to kill 9 out of 10 people. That's why I'm alive. You just said us all broke along the way.
Okay, fast forward 5 or 10 years. Where's Alan Jones and where's Australia?
Oh, in 5 or 10 years, I'll be talking to Pete Evans again. And I'll be visiting him at his Byron Bay retreat. You've got a lovely spot up there. You made a big choice.
I did. We actually...
Byron Bay man, let me tell you.
We actually just bought a health retreat, which will be opening in a couple of months. So you're more than welcome to spend a week with us.
It'd be lovely, Pete. Lovely to talk to you.
But where do you think Australia will be in 5 or 10 years, if you had your way?
In debt, unless we get some visionary people who can manifest a way in which we can grow the economy, because this mob here have left an appalling legacy. But look, we're resilient people, somehow are. We've always managed. We hang in there. But I hope we haven't taken that for granted. I hope we haven't pushed the line too far. I think that what the government have done here is really stretching the capacity and the patience of Australians beyond what they've ever been asked to achieve, even in war. This didn't happen in war. We didn't do this in 1914. We didn't do it in 1918 with the Spanish flu. I mean, I ask people, it's a little Trivial Pursuits question, but do you remember the swine flu? And they say, what? I said, the swine flu. Don't you remember the swine flu? Well, I said, hang on, now have a look at the thing today. Here's an table. In Australia today, there are currently, for coronavirus, there are currently in Australia today, let me see here, there are currently 25,000 cases. There were 39,000 cases of swine flu in 2009. No one closed the place down. There are 191 deaths. No one closed the joint down. No, you don't even remember it. I don't remember it. I was broadcasting. I didn't talk about swine flu every day. I mean, this is where we are. This is the deception that's been perpetrated against Australians, and it does no justice to our political leaders.
Alan, I love you, brother. Thank you for your time and thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. Catch up.
I look forward to sharing some of your stories.
I think we've both got plenty of them. All right, Pete.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed the health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows, and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.